I am the master, and you will obey me. Of course, I'm joking, for I have no earthly reason to use coercion when I implore you to pay heed to this, the final episode, the very apotheosis of TV Cream Countdown, the 50 greatest Doctor Who moments. Why, listen for yourself to this enticing summary of what's coming up.
The meeting can now begin.
No,
a chance to know heaven.
What's all this about?
This is Jeffrey from a 1970 Doctor Who story with the Silurians that I've been told to call Doctor Who and the Silurians.
I don't like it.
And just when it seemed about to sink under a tsunami of Ginger Hair and Gingham, came this pair of bright barkers.
Rum-ti-tum, knock on the door.
Yat-a-ta-ta. You see? Most exciting. And so far be it from me to impede your progress any further. I shall leave you to the delights of this podcast while I am going to return to my study of The War of the Worlds. Still haven't finished that book. That audio book.
Our top 10 countdown begins, naturally, at number 10, with a Monkhouse memo.
Hello, this is Bob Monkhouse. Do you know, the first thing I said when my agent telephoned me to tell me I'd been asked to take part in this TV Cream podcast was, "Yes, operator, I'll accept the charges." But once the old miser outlined the premise of TV Cream Countdown, the 50 greatest Doctor Who moments, I knew immediately what my contribution was going to be. As mercilessly short as I could get away with. I'm only kidding. I'm as big a Whovian as the next guy, as long as that next guy isn't Ian Levine. Do you know, they even asked me to be in a Doctor Who once. A story called Delta and the Bannerman. Did he do it, I hear you ask? No, Doddy did it.
They were going to Disneyland, planet Earth, when they struck the satellite.
I couldn't make room for it in my schedule, so he took up the role of the Tollmaster.
They were blown off course. I don't know where.
He died about 20 minutes in, though. Which is a personal best for Ken. Sadly, science fiction has never really been the route for me. Instead, much of my career has been spent in game shows, posing questions I already know the answer to, and hanging around with attractive young women who are only there to make me look good. Hey, maybe Doctor Who and I aren't quite so different after all. In fact, now I come to think of it, quite a few of the Doctors have also delved into the world of game shows. So hang on to your headphones, folks, as I deliver a Monkhouse memo on the five Doctors who put themselves on the hotspot.
Well, there were three letters.
Mm-hmm.
Two of them were Bill's, and one was to the Doctor Who fan club to ask for your autograph.
Ask us, I've got some photographs.
Oh, thank you.
Collapse of stout party.
Third Doctor John Pertwee there, trying to solve a murder on Thames Television's 1972 panel game, Who Done It? Of course, the only real crime being committed was by John himself, who'd steal the show from host Edward Woodward and become its presenter from the second series onwards. You might say that was quite a masterstroke. If only a masterstroke wasn't what Roger Delgado got up to whenever he had time on his hands in the TARDIS. 2 decades on, John's Doctor Who successor Tom Baker landed a not-so-plum professorial role on another murder mystery game, Granada's Cluedo.
You are invited to a murder.
And it was Professor Plum.
Yes, I killed him. He came here so full of conceit, not looking for the truth. He would lie, cheat, and threaten for a lurid headline.
Professor Plum there in the drawing room with a spanner. Or Richard Madeley, as he's more commonly known. Doctor number five was Peter Davison. And here he is in the year 2000 on Jonathan Ross's It's Only TV, But I Like It.
Alien number three, I'm a doctor, would you trust me?
Yes, shall I take my clothes off?
I don't like it. I worked with Wassie on a comedy game show back in 1994, Gag Tag, died such a death before we knew it, it was bagged and tagged. But I digress. It's bingo lingo clickety clicks. It's time to take your pick of Dr. Six. Colin Baker, of course. And there's plenty to choose from. Dear old Colin has been on nearly as many game shows as I. From Eggheads.
Hello, I'm Colin Baker.
To Come Dine With Me. To I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. And to All-Star Mr. and Mrs.
Question three. You play the role of the sixth Doctor in Doctor Who. If Marion could dress you as one of the other Time Lords, who would she choose?
Incidentally, the other day my wife asked me to dress as one of the other Time Lords. The Master, in fact. Oh, I thought. Is that because she sees me as a rather mesmerising bad boy? Sadly, no. It turns out because, like so many victims of the Master's bulbous-headed stick weapon, whenever I get mine out, she literally shrinks away. Ah, but Colin. He's appeared on The Generation Game, Crosswits, Pointless, The Weakest Link, Countdown, Star Games. Gosh, so many. I don't even think my slut of a sister Beryl could spread herself that wide. And finally, we come to Sylvester McCoy, the seventh Doctor, famous for rolling his R's, and sometimes for making a bit of an R's of himself. Which leads us to Channel 4's Space Cadets in 1997.
Wow. It's amazing what actors have got to do, isn't it? That's kind of, you know that thing in his hat? What hat was it? As he went down, he pulled that, and there was a gas canister, and it blew him up like a big balloon, and they floated off and drank champagne.
Yeah.
I should also mention that competing against him in that episode was a delightful young actress who played his companion Ace, Sophie Aldred. But how to get from Sophie Aldred to a suitable closing line for me? Well, let's see. Aldred pretty much sums up my feelings when I was invited to contribute to this TV cream project. And TV cream makes you think of a kind of television dairy. What would we yield from such an establishment? I'm not sure. Other than a show with maddeningly fast end credits that speed pasteurise. But how much is the Butterworth, I hear you ask? Which makes me think of my old pal Peter Butterworth, with whom I appeared with in the funny film She'll Have to Go back in 1962. And then, wouldn't you know it, a couple of years later, Peter showed up in a Doctor Who story called The Time Meddler. And in that story... Ah, we've reached our ending as your very own meddling Monkhouse bids you farewell for now. Oh, and remember, folks, as Doctor Who turns 50, growing old is compulsory. Growing up is optional.
Number 9. Audio Adventures.
Audio recordings made by fans are important to Doctor Who. Without them, we wouldn't have this.
Molly, Ben, come in and meet the Daleks.
Or this.
I don't like this place.
Or, brace yourselves, this.
Kill these two men. Nothing in the world can stop me now.
That's, of course, The Underwater Menace there by Geoffrey Orme of And Cheap fame.
If only I could fly.
But what do those who start every audio recording with an angry shushing of their sister do with their recording playfingers when there's nothing on telly to tape? Well, at TV Cream a few years ago, we asked that very question and so began collating an oral picture of the 1980s via the TDKs, Memorexes and Maxels.
Are you expecting someone else?
No, not you, Colin. As recorded on by you, the great British you. And we discovered that when you stop pointing the microphone at the big telly, you start pointing it at each other and pretend that you are the ones who are actually on the big telly.
Hello, Yuri. Still using that cheap washing powder again?
Yes? What's wrong with it?
Well, try this. It's called Santa. It makes your words even whiter.
Does it really?
You don't get accents like that anymore, do you? Anyway, in amongst overdubbed a cappella a la flying picaresque pubescent versions of the EastEnders theme tune... and manic renditions of mid-80s anarchic comedy shows.
Hi, oh, I'm Benny Hill, the UK, greatest joke in the world. That is Britain, bloody, bloody, bloody. Okay.
Just your average sounding late 80s obnoxious schoolboy with his mates off to complete, apparently, an exercise set by their school to capture the sounds of the city. Over the course of their oral odyssey, they move betwixt shopping precincts and amusement arcades, capturing Britain just before the age of mobile phone technology and always connected social networking. It was a simpler time. Did that last bit sound too grandiose?
I mean, you sounded as if you were a fucking infant teacher.
Oh, blimey. Sorry, Tom. Is it okay for me to continue?
Yeah. Ready when you are.
Speaking of Tom Baker and audio, the one-time Julie T. Wallace humping actor is undoubtedly the Doctor Who most attuned to the audio medium. His chocolatey tones have hawked all manner of wares down the years, from symphony sofas to the musing of the erstwhile DCI Mike Hatter.
Get off my manor.
In his later, some might say less successful incarnation of Little Britain's David Walliams, or is that Divad Williams? We can never remember. Tom's vocal tones might be heard on radio and television a little less often these days, but there was a time when it seemed as if you couldn't turn a corner without coming ear to ear with that voice. And so it was for Group A4, always our favourite paper size, as their journey around London took them into Soho and straight into a chance meeting from beyond the constellation of Cerberus. And so there you are, just one of many epistopic interfaces between Who Stars and the general public, but a rarity for having been caught on tape. And it's thanks to that fragile medium of magnetically coated plastic tape contained within a plastic casing that the obscure moments of Who history are still available to us. And thanks too to those that pointed the mic, synchronised the pressing of the record and play buttons, and had the presence of mind to hold on to their old shoeboxes so that they could stuff them to the gunnels with wonderful bits of TV and social history.
Are you sure this isn't a translation from the fucking Albanian?
Number 8. Lesbian Cannibal Killers.
Remember the 80s?
recession.
Her strategy of defying the Keynesian consensus by hiking taxes and launching a monetarist attack on inflation plunged the economy even deeper into recession.
Miners' strike.
56,000 men in the Yorkshire mining district, the biggest, most elite group of Britain's miners, and Arthur Scargill's personal power base, have been called out on strike next Monday.
Red wedge.
It's the first time that a lineup of pop musicians have linked themselves openly with a major political party.
Clause 28.
I was just curious as to whether you found the Tory idea of clause 28 offensive, because it is like a disgraceful abuse of people who,
it does seem to me that they are closing up a lot of freedoms. We'll do some
shopping. AIDS.
So don't die of ignorance. If you
pass the poll tax.
If the Prime Minister had her time again, would she still introduce the poll tax?
Yes, sir.
That's not really working, is it? Well, how about this? Remember the 80s. Now the world don't move to the beat. Oh, that's more like it. Cans of Quattro. Pound puppies.
Those lonely pound puppies really need to be rescued.
Strawberry shortcake. Visage. The Goonies. Ah, yes, those were the days, apparently. But in amongst all the lazy slag, cliche retro bollocks was this. The most extraordinarily bizarre epoch of popular children's television programme Doctor Who ever. Well, mind you, it started well.
It's the end. But the moment has been prepared for.
And no one could complain about your actual Peter Davison.
Look out!
I must save Hagrid!
He couldn't, of course, and for that we can all be truly thankful. Whoa. Then it all went, well, it all went a bit 80s. That is to say, a bit shit. A poor Colin Baker was ill-used, and by the time he'd been and gone and come back again, then gone again, the old girl was on the ropes.
Makes you sound a rather egotistical young lady.
The era we might most generously refer to as the Sylvester McCoy experiment is, well, baffling.
I cannot understand how I could have made such a fundamental mistake.
There's been plenty of retrospective chat about the programme at this time being a devastating critique of the Thatcher years.
The Happiness Patrol is this wonderful political satire.
Except it wasn't. Unless the decision by Tory party grandees in November 1990 was in fact a well-disguised last-ditch effort to get Doctor Who back on air. So well-disguised that it didn't work. As she lasted longer than poor Sly did.
Has she indeed?
Revisionist cobblers aside though, there was so much wrong with the stories produced for the hapless Seventh Doctor that it's difficult to know where to begin. The random guest appearances.
They were going to Disneyland, planet Earth, when they struck the satellite. They were blown off course. I don't know where.
Well, there's a metaphor for you. It did have the look of a show shot in a camcorder, and if the return series seems to feature a preponderance of subterranean Welsh corridors, where they still seem like the set of Cleopatra compared to what was on offer here, a mise-en-scene that seemed more like a home movie, with the director's annoying daughter as the star. Oh, dear Lord. Poor Who. The real tragedy is that, when it really tried, it could still produce the goods. So when Paradise Towers loomed into view in Only McCoy's second story back in 87, we were ready for some tense moments after the big hair and deadly, deadly midges of Time in the Ranny.
Well, we try.
So you say.
Unfortunately, it didn't seem too promising. The usual headlong rush into a story that no one really got a chance to understand. Got underway, and there followed the equally usual tumble of characters and exposition that meant not a lot to anyone.
I've always made sure you've had lots of tender little morsels to make you big and strong.
And just when it seemed about to sink under a tsunami of ginger hair and gingham, came this pair of right barkers.
Hooey! Hooey!
Would you care for a cup of tea?
Hello?
I said, would you like a cup of tea and some cakes?
Suddenly, with some genuinely interesting characters, and an air of dread in the air, and, it has to be said, some actual proper acting, the stark, overlit sets became menacingly incongruous. We were plunged into the netherworld of Tabby and Tilda, a pair of very close, very hungry old dears, as sinister in their way as any Dalek or cyber twat, and certainly a scarier than Nina Sharples Davros.
My friend Tabby is just tidying up. We're both very house proud, you see, particularly when we have guests. Yes, I think it's all right to go in now. Come in, dear. I'm Tilda, by the way. What's your name?
Mel.
Oh, Mel. Mel, what a delicious name. Tabby, this is Mel.
Hello.
Hello, dear.
But then, as soon as it materialised, it was gone.
I am Pex, and I am the...
Howdy, Cutler!
And then it was back to Robot Lobsters and Bertha's narkier cousin down in the basement.
I am ready now. I have my plan.
It was a roller coaster ride trying to love Doctor Who in the late 80s. For every Tabby and Tilda, or Fenric, or little girl in a crash helmet, or even Ainley...
But this is the end, Doctor.
...was another load of old shit about the gods of Ragnarok, or Wallace Arnold in space.
You have won our fabulous 50s tour. A whole week in Disneyland, planet Earth. And this time, they're going back to 1959, the rock and roll year.
Fact is, fag end Doctor Who wasn't bad. It was sad. As the lesbian cannibal killers of Paradise Towers demonstrated, it really could work.
There you are.
And with the time of survival, the relationship between the Doctor and Ace was just hitting a stride that could have carried it over into a fourth consecutive decade in pretty good shape. Well, as long as they changed sets, the tape, the writers, the costumes, the lighting, the producer. But if all this seems terribly negative, what it demonstrates is that even the dead hand of a corporation not interested in its own product couldn't keep down a series that was so deeply rooted in the gums of the nation that could only ever rise again, in some form or other. And it would simply refuse to... Well, it would simply refuse to die.
No, my dear Doctor, you must die. Die, Doctor. Die, Doctor.
Number 7. Geoffrey Palmer gets the Lurgy.
The permanent undersecretary, sir.
What are you doing, man? Let me speak to him.
There's no need, sir. I meant he's actually here in the centre. He's on his way down in the lift now.
That's all I need.
What's he come here for, sir?
I sent for him.
When you send for Geoffrey Palmer, preferably in the guise of a besuited emissary from officialdom, it's not just your staff that need to look sharp. Your wordplay must be top draw, too. Especially if he's turned up to investigate Doctor Who's greatest enemy of the early 1970s. Red tape gone mad.
Hello, Charles.
Hello, Edward.
What's all this about?
This is Geoffrey from a 1970 Doctor Who story with the Silurians that I've been told to call Doctor Who and the Silurians.
I didn't expect to see you until much later.
I've got to report to a meeting in London tomorrow. But any chance some coffee?
Coffee?
You can hear how, within seconds, he effortlessly outwits that middle management dunderhead, thanks to the classic opening beverage gambit, which elicits the equally textbook grovel.
Oh yes, of course, I'm sorry.
But sadly for Geoffrey, coffee isn't the only thing he's about to imbibe. For when you send for Geoffrey Palmer in Doctor Who, you not only get a bloody impressive entrance, you get an impressively bloody exit too. Here, Geoffrey contrives to get infected by alien lurgy, one that doesn't simply knock you flat out, but makes you stagger around fine examples of late 60s brutalist architecture, past girls in knee-high white socks, occasionally pausing to poke your lime-hued face through some railings. All to the sounds of a child bumping into a Casio keyboard. Dies in a heap on the pavement, with two bobbies looking on. It's one of the best deaths in Doctor Who history, which is to say, simultaneously one of the most entertaining and the most chilling. The Lurgy went on to be lectured to death by Doctor Who John Pertwee. But thankfully, the red tape lived to fight another day.
Number 6. The Ultimate Adventure.
Sorry. Excuse me. Oh, sorry. Oh, hi, Charlie Brown's teacher. You're late. I did say 1989. The show's already started. Take your seat. What's that? That's John Pertwee. He's the one before the one who looks like Shirley Williams. Shirley Williams. What's that? Oh, yes, he does look like Helen 12 Trees. This isn't telly, though, so you can't talk through. This is theatre. For the only time ever in the history of Doctor Who, the Doctor is just there in front of us, actually being the Doctor. It's so thrilling, but we've got to be quiet. What's on the other side? No, this isn't telly. John Pertwee is just there on stage being the Doctor, in the flesh. This is the ultimate adventure. Actually, it's slightly mind-blowing for a Doctor Who fan to experience this, but also a bit awkward seeing how the show tries to embrace certain theatrical traditions without completely losing that special Doctor Who quality. Well, like including awful songs about wanting to be a star and taking a couple of steps upstage and thinking that no one else can hear you. Oh, and shit fighting. The fighting in theatre is always shit. It's great though, don't you think? Oh, so you never liked Pertwee? His chin stroking annoyed you? And his lisp?
Well, I've never noticed that.
Okay, well, as it happens, I do have with me a magic theatrical hoofadoofa. I found it down the side of the sofa in the Payne's house when I was round to collect Andrew Collins' big white trainers. The point is, with my magic theatrical hoofadoofa, I can do this and change the Doctor. Look, he's turned into Colin Baker. Hey? Oh, you were expecting someone else. Sorry about that, but watch. Look how he and John Pertwee... Sorry, Pertwee. Each approach this scene with Maggie Thatcher. Let me just flip between them, like so.
Margaret. How very nice to see you again.
Well, what is it this time, Maggie?
What on earth are you doing here?
I was under the impression that you'd sent for me.
Didn't you get my signal?
Yes, tell him to come at once to number 10. That's why I'm here.
Not this number 10, you silly man.
So, do you see? The character of the Doctor changes slightly depending on who's playing him. When David Banks played him for one night, his Doctor wore white pumps and tried to push the companion, Crystal, off some scaffolding. Yes, excellent. Oh no, here comes that song, Business is Business. Right, that's my cue to slink off and do my business. Excuse me. Oh, so what's your overall take on the Ultimate Adventure then? Yes, it's a pretty decent fist of trying to do Doctor Who on the stage, certainly preferable to the later Doctor Who Live with Nigel Planer, which not only didn't feature an on-stage incarnation of the Doctor, but didn't even really have a Doctor Who-type plot. The Ultimate Adventure story was a bit of a run-round, but no more so than, say, The Chase, and with the songs accepted, it did feel reasonably canonical, and at least they didn't make the Doctor sing, which has to be... Hang on, if I remember correctly, Charlie Brown's teacher was a woman. You are a woman. Well, then what are you doing in the gents' loos? Get out! Good grief.
Number 5. The Delegates.
With the arrival of our ally, Malfa, we are enough. The meeting can now begin.
Mission to the Unknown, the long-lost single-episode Dalek epic trailer one-off oddity that's famous for not featuring the Doctor or any of his companions should in fact be more famous for the characters they actually did feature.
What do you mean?
By which we don't mean Space Security Agent Mark Corey or his fellow astronauts where nobody can decide what costumes they were really wearing on screen, but the Daleks' plot-cahooting alien allies the Planetarians, or, as they would become better known in the then forthcoming 12-part epic The Daleks' Master Plan, the Delegates. You may well think that you've seen weird enough and indeed cheap enough costumes in the bits of 60s Doctor Who that do still exist, but this bunch would have kept the writers of a piss-poor sketch in a piss-poor mid-80s comedy show hard at work for months. Nobody's quite certain of which one was which, as they seem to have a habit of changing appearance, and in some cases name, between appearances. But as far as experts can tell, the one with a map drawn on his head was Malfa, the one who looked like Patrick Troughton with spikes on his face was Trantis, the one who looked like Harry Hill full stop was Geeran, the clump of dry grass in a cloak was Zephon, the escapee from a space-themed Fisher-Price Adventure People playset was Baeus, the one who looked like he'd been attacked by an automatic cake icing machine was Salation, Tony Parsons with a cushion cover wedged on his head was Warrion, and, most infamous of all, the one who looked like a cross between a chess piece and a satanic Christmas tree was Centriol. And while the whole time destructor escapade was going on, the Delegates apparently preferred to spend their time arguing over who was the Daleks' best and, well, banging tables. They didn't exactly have the most sensible of voices either.
Upgrade! Agreed!
All are agreed! It is done! The seven great powers of the outer galaxies are one!
Our galactic domination!
We are the mightiest in the universe!
Sadly, after 12 weeks worth of ridiculously costumed fun, they were never seen again. Apart from when Salation presented junior points of view. No, really.
The seven of us represent the greatest war force ever assembled. Conquest is assured. Mars. Venus. Jupiter. The moon colonies!
They will all fall before our might, but the first of them will be Earth!
That wasn't it.
Number 4. Honking!
Oh, what do I remember of Christmas 1981? I was, I suppose I was 18. Yeah, it was the sad winter in the top dead centre of Thatcherism.
Toughness is not being inhumane. Any mother will tell you.
Everyone was trying to find a way of escaping.
Have a cracking Christmas!
Either buying big motorcycles, taking drugs, or getting drunk. Or, or partying up with, like, little doggy robots. I don't know.
This is Ian Sears, who, on the 28th of December 1981, starred as Brendan Richards in Canine and Company. And he's talking to TV Cream from his Los Angeles home.
I'm a footnote of a footnote.
It's the first time he's ever gone on record about his role in the first and, let's face it, best Doctor Who spin-off. Torchwood was always a little too light for our liking on market gardening storylines and chat about soil pH levels. But where did it all begin for Ian?
I just started by acting in the school plays, and like some kids for whom getting in a band captures their imagination and that becomes their thing, acting became my thing. And I contacted the Anna Scher Theatre. So anyway, I was lucky enough to get in. I think I was on their waiting list for 9 months, and that just became the organizing principle of my life. It was just the best fun, the thing that I wanted to do, that it really caught fire at me. And so then I started auditioning and I started landing jobs, and that became my passion.
Having appeared in the Children's Film Foundation's 1979 high-voltage Inuit superhero flick Electric Eskimo, and yes, that was a real thing.
Unidentified object in danger area. Condition red.
I remember, yes, there was an electric Eskimo who could light up a light bulb by holding it.
He was invited to audition at the BBC in front of K9 & Company's director, John Black.
I auditioned along with a bunch of other people, sure, yeah. And there undoubtedly must have been a callback or two. And, I was very lucky, very, very lucky.
Also on hand was Doctor Who producer John Nathan Turner.
I suspect he had the final call on it. I know they were a little concerned about my accent because I was a little too North London and I had to sort of plumb it up a bit, which is sort of ironic, a very sort of English thing, actually, because I was going to this posh private school, but in order to blend in Anna Scher, I was sort of put on this slightly more London accent, which kind of stuck. And then I was getting complaints at the other end of it.
Here's Ian poshing it up in Brendan's standout scene.
You're a computer.
Affirmative.
And a robot.
Affirmative.
Just look at that. He's fantastic.
Negative. An efficient machine.
What a find. Tri-state bus driver.
Affirmative.
A bus driver?
Oh, a bus is a microchip distributing data throughout a motherboard.
Oh.
And a UART?
Affirmative.
What's that?
Universal asynchronous receiver transmitter.
Q.
Nuclear battery?
Affirmative.
Self-charging?
Naturally.
And I bet he's got holographic memory.
Affirmative.
Knew it!
By all accounts, when the show went in front of the cameras, John Black wasn't quite up to speed with the production.
Is he still alive? The thing is that I don't particularly want to be unkind to him, but certainly he wasn't terribly well respected on that shoot, and he had the nickname of John Gray.
As a result, JNT was a constant presence throughout the show.
I did see John Nathan Turner concerned on the set, but remember, I was a kid and I was an actor, and you're living in parallel universes. You don't really fully tune into what's happening on the executive level. You know, I definitely had a sense that he was the man at the helm.
As for K9 & Company's
mistress,
Elizabeth Sladen, Ian recalls,
I really liked her a lot, actually. And I'll tell you why, because, you know, I've worked with stars of different calibers and some quite big ones, and there's most of them are really professional and really good at what they do, as she is or was. But she was very inclusive. You know, there's usually that feeling between the star in which they make it known that they're the star, even if it's done in a subtle way. You know, I'm the captain and you're the crew. And she was very inclusive and very warm, which I thought was generous to an 18-year-old unknown. So I liked her. I liked her a lot.
He also has fond memories of K9 himself, or at least the voice of K9, actor and sometime magistrate John Leeson. Back in the day, it was said he'd get on all fours during Doctor Who rehearsals. So, did he do the same in this production?
Yes, he did. He was a very earnest method actor. And actually, there was one time in which Liz made the mistake of putting a newspaper on the floor, and he went over and peed on it. Which was a little embarrassing, but we thought was, you know, whatever his process is, you have to respect it.
For much of K9 & Company, Brendan is held by a gang of yokel occultists who dress him in a skimpy nightshirt before spreading him out on a sacrificial platter.
Well, I was just perfectly dressed to go to a disco afterwards and get picked up by the locals. It was awesome. Jail bed. No, it was fine except for that one scene, the sacrifice scene, where it was extremely cold, and I was, as you put it, skimpily dressed, And but the extras, I remember being particularly sweet and protective, and they would rally round with the torches in between takes to keep me warm.
So if that wasn't unwholesome enough, there was also a palpable sense of something else going on in the seemingly cosseted hamlet. Something a bit wife-swappy.
I've been talking to Howard, and we don't think you should be left on your own. Come to dinner.
Tonight?
Yes, take your mind off things. And by then, we might have some news for you.
Oh, that's very kind of you, but, well, I'm a bit tired.
Oh, we won't be late. We'll have you tucked up in bed well before midnight.
Oh, it's all over it. It was wife's absolutely categorically true. And some husband swapping. And I have to say, I think at certain times, I think even Canine was in danger of being roped in.
Despite decent viewing figures and the unresolved sexual tension between Sarah Jane Smith and Juno and Howard Baker, the BBC Time Lords decided that Canine wasn't to be granted his own continuing TV series after all.
I was disappointed it wasn't picked up, but it was just on to the next... onto the next thing.
Which is a shame, because it could have been a big deal, with loads of merchandise like Canine storybooks, a Sarah Jane Smith alfresco typewriter, a Canine & Company car keys bowl, and maybe a series of Canine & Company audio adventures which bring to life the exciting stories from the 1983 Canine & Company annual.
Brendan froze, one foot resting on solid ground, the other half lifted out of the marshy ground into which it had sunk a second earlier. "Sorry, Sarah," he whispered back, "but I can't help it. You can't tell what's marsh and what isn't." With a cautious look around, he slowly lifted the trapped foot. It came free of the mud with a horrible squelching sound. Brendan winced. "If you think I'm having problems, look at Canine. He's just not built for this sort of thing."
"Mistress."
Ah, we can but dream.
I thought it was cute.
Says Ian, who's just watched the show again for the first time since its transmission.
It's so quintessentially English, isn't it? It's, you know, I've lived out of England for a long time now, and it was just the production, the set, everything's sort of brown and green, and the clothes just make you, they just make you want to cross-dress and smoke crack, don't they? I mean, it's just... just everything, more tea, it's all just so very, very English, but a lot of fun, and definitely a sort of like a little crystallization of a time and a place. Well, I kind of saw it through my kid's eyes, and he was, my son is an American, he was astonished at how different my accent was to what it is now. He said, "Oh, you sound so English, Dad." And I said, "Well, I am English," but obviously my accent has become, apparently, to English ears, rounded out over the 20-odd years I've lived in California.
What, though, did Ian, who's worked for the last two decades as an editor in the American film and TV industry, make of those opening titles?
Well, I have to say, as an editor, just speaking as an editor, I read somewhere recently that it was voted as the worst ever title sequence ever. And I have to say, I probably would have given it that vote. I mean, it's the reuse of the same shot and those sort of horrible 70s zooms. And it's terrible. I mean, God bless him, but... or her, that editor, but really, it seemed lazy, actually.
But yes, there is one thing we've been skirting around here. The honking.
Canine!
Brendan, stop honking!
It was an issue Ian had only just broached with his son.
He said, What's that honking? And I said, I can't remember. Well, let's have a look at it. So we looked at it together, and he almost fell off his chair when we came to the honking and said, Dad, you should be a meme.
And of course he is. But here's the thing. Perhaps secretly, the real reason we took the time to track down Ian Sears, Brendan off of Canine & Company, to his Los Angeles home in the first place, well, it was this. Can he still do the honk today? To order? Let's find out.
Oh, hold on. You know what?
Have a glass of water.
Okay. I'll see if I can get you a honk. Okay. I think you got one there.
Number three.
The Everything of Rassilon.
There's an inherent problem with setting up a mythology for a programme when you're just making it up as you go along. Most fancy schmancy new shows will come with a Bible that sets up who everyone is, where they came from, what their motivation is, what they got for O-level, Latin and biology, their colour. All of this will be put up on the show's website and used to punt the exercise as, say, a holistic experience of some sort. But since popular children's television programme Doctor Who was created before the internet, and that's not to say before the internet in a way that allows some dick to claim that the internet was around for years before punters were able to access it with home computers, but it was there for beardy wonks to chat over university and defence networks, connected by putting phones into big rubber sockets or something. We really do mean before the internet. There was never a coherent plan for who the Doctor was, where the hell Susan came from, what a TARDIS was beyond an acronym, and indeed what William Hartnell would have worn before he came to 60s London, bought a scary hat and scarf, and started swinging like a pendulum do.
We are wanderers in the fourth dimensions of space and time, cut off from our own planet and our own people.
Anyway, what tends all this preface is that as the legend of the Time Lord started to take shape, so did the mythology of Rassilon. Architect, literally, of much of Gallifrey, and tender of the very finest moustache. All good, but for a wee while, it got a bit out of hand. There's a lot of the everything of Rassilon in Deadly Assassin, but it only really kicked in with the epic Five Doctors. And by that time we had... In at number 10, it's the Game of Rassilon.
This is the Game of Rassilon.
Don't try playing it after dinner at Christmas. He who wins loses, and he who loses shall win, and that's a big argument right there.
To lose is to win, and he who wins shall lose.
At number 9, it's the Tomb of Rassilon. Where the man himself lies, and, thanks to apparently ingenious Gallifreyan housekeeping technology, dusting is not an issue.
This is the Tomb of Rassilon?
Number 8, and it's the Black Scrolls of Rassilon.
Black Scrolls of Rassilon.
Have you got the scrolls?
No, I always walk like this.
They might look like comedy cigars or rolled up Mars bars, but watch out. They have a habit of spontaneously combusting. Oh, there they go now. 7 is the Ring of Rassilon.
Takes the ring.
No pardon.
And at 6, the Coronet of Rassilon.
I wear the Coronet of Rassilon.
Worn with a fetching black headpiece, this beautiful gold-plated circlet is studded with the finest multicoloured crystals. Not only is it absolutely gorgeous, it emphasises the will and allows you to control other minds, which is fabulous. Holding on at number 5 is the Voice of Rassilon.
That was the Voice of Rassilon.
Which isn't much to speak of, except that it emanates from someone who's dead. The Sash of Rassilon is at number 4, and no, don't get excited, Ulsterman. It's just a device that protects the wearer from temporal and gravitational extremes surrounding the Eye of Harmony. More innuendo in at number 3 with the Rod of Rassilon.
No pardon!
And just short of the top spot at number 2 is the Harp of Rassilon.
The Harp of Rassilon.
A harp Rassilon likes so much, he seems to have had an oil painting of himself playing it set in a place so he could look at it while he was playing it.
Diabolical ingenuity!
And at number 1, it's the Key of Rassilon. Or is that the same as the Rod of Rassilon?
No pardon!
Probably. Apart from sounding a bit silly, the most annoying thing about all this everything of Rassilon is that they didn't even think to merchandise it all. A mistake not made, subsequently, by more savvy sci-fi types.
Merchandising! Merchandising! Where the real money from the movie is made.
Well, never mind. At least we were spared bottles of Timothy Dalton-inspired The Spittle of Rassilon.
Number 2. The Day They Came Back.
Now,
in a moment I'm going to introduce Roy Robinson from TIEA to read a brief statement from Philip Morris, the man who tracked down the missing episodes we're announcing today.
On Thursday, the 10th of October 2013, a huddle of television enthusiasts, Doctor Who fans, and journos found themselves called together by a force for good in a room in central London. With the exception of the journos, albeit most of them were also signed up members of the Telianorak or Whovian brigades, this was a scene typical from any fan group meeting. A coming together of like-minded aficionados to enjoy an obscure bit of black and white telly. But this was something different. It was the righting of a wrong that was perpetrated back in 1972. This was something very, very big.
The People claims that a group of dedicated Doctor Who fans have tracked down at least 100 long-lost episodes of the show from the 1960s in Ethiopia.
Well, it's the nine missing episodes. I can't remember how they something to do with the library and the archive.
Now, Time Lord fans all over Great Britain have been smiling over their sonic screwdrivers today at the discovery of nine...
For its first 9 years or so, Doctor Who's archival record was unblemished. In fact, by the end of 1969, the score was a perfect 253 for 253. But then, well, you know what happened next. We might call it the Omni-wipe. Hartnells became Hartnills, and Troughtons, Troughtoffs.
No! You can't do this to me!
Oh, for heaven's sake, I've never heard such nonsense!
Attaching themselves like melting icebergs.
Ah, do something, help him!
Oh no, it's all right. If it all worked out soon, everything's all right. Everything's quite all right.
The wiping of much of early Doctor Who did nothing good for the show except provide a certain kind of fan with a very special type of currency. When the full list of Missing Who episodes became widely known, thanks to the 1981 Winter Special of Doctor Who magazine, the initial horror gave way to a realisation that, as Karl Marx might have put it, scarcity is a functional requirement of capitalism itself. Or, as Richard Marx puts it, if I see you next to never, how can we say forever?
This year is the 20th anniversary of the world's longest-running television science fiction programme, the BBC's Doctor Who. And as part of the celebration's historic past has been brought together with science future, for an Easter weekend exhibition at Longgate House in Wiltshire.
Dateline 1983 and the missing episode Misinformation Merry-Go-Round really get started at the Longleat convention when a collective of cagoule-wearing diamond logos devotees spend their Easter weekend on a pilgrimage to attend an ambitious two-day itinerary of queuing and fellow fans getting annoyed with each other. It's here that word spreads that the most recent edition of the fanzine Scarrow carries within it a claim that a shadowy Doctor Who fan has within his or her possession, but let's face it, his, a copy of Episode 4 of The Tenth Planet and all of the Macra Terror.
When I walk through the gates of 1978 of the BBC Video Archive, come to see if they knew, if they had any who, in particular where were Fear 5.
Within a couple of years, rumours begin to emanate from the Doctor Who shop in Wapping, which we recall as being more difficult to locate than any of the six parts of The Key to Time.
Key to Time is a perfect cue.
Or even the four parts of The Fury from the Deep, the story that is. The rumour is that the owner is holding on to a copy of The Web of Fear. Who knows what happened to that? Perhaps the Who shop proprietor lost his luggage on a weekend break to Nigeria.
Scatter!
Then, circa 1988, DWB, the fanzine J&T most liked to read whilst in a frenzied rage, prints a letter claiming the power of the Daleks exists on video. Also in 1988, a fan called Darren Gregory hoaxes a number of Whovians into believing he's holding episodes 1 and 2 of the aforementioned Fury from the Deep. As hoaxes go, this one's pretty successful, winding up in the pages of Doctor Who magazine, and Darren winding Hoover fan Ian Levine up on the telephone.
one scene, you can clearly see a treasure map which shows you where all the rest of the missing episodes to be located.
Oh my God, this is too much to hope for.
Where there's a secret stash of unpublished Golden Age DC comics and a massive pile of Northern Soul records.
Look, tell me slowly, what's the next
step?
Oh.
As in like the Pink Floyd. Goodbye.
Darren Gregory continues to be a pain in the archives for Doctor Who fans, leading many of them on wild goose chases to Blackpool for supposed tape drops. For example, in 1997, he places an ad in Loot offering to exchange the 10th Planet Episode 4 for Power of the Daleks. But whenever a meeting is set up, Darren somehow fails to show. In return, Doctor Who fans stick his telephone number out on the internet so that this seemingly attention-serving fantasist can be completely starved of... Oh. But what of the aforementioned Roger K. Barrett? His story is told as part of the BBC's 1993 Missing in Action mini-documentary. But in short, it's another hoax, one that briefly ensnares Mark Gatiss into a rather silly adventure which ends up with no proper payoff. That'll be the inspiration for Victory of the Daleks, then.
It's a shit business.
And Barrett drives Ian Levine into a fit of fist-clenching frustration.
If I could get hold of this Roger Barrett, I think I'd just grab hold of him by the scruff of his neck and choke him until I found out why he'd misled everybody. What kind of idiot does he take us all for?
That Ian manfully takes in his stride.
I wish I could get hold of him.
So, with all of this disappointment, and only the occasional missing episode turning up over the years, it's little surprise, then, that Who fans grow weary of the subject altogether. Dateline 2005. Doctor Who is back on our screens, and one fan feels moved to post this on an internet forum.
Does anyone know what Ian Levine plans to do about the recovery of missing episodes? I myself have been considering a little overseas travel. I work overseas, and I think by travelling to some or even all countries and searching is maybe the best way now of finally putting the rumours and stories to rest. If it's there, let's go there and ask politely. It can do no harm. Who knows? I might turn up a thing or two.
Blah, blah, blah. It seems like just so much chatter. Dateline Boxing Day 2009. Radio 4 takes a break from having Stephen Fry read out the contents of J.K. Rowling's litter bin, or whatever it does over Christmas, to bring us a programme on missing Doctor Who. It features
Phil Morris. He works with Sue Malden and describes himself as an episode hunter.
But breaks no news of the recovery of anything.
It's a little bit of a mystery trail. Sometimes you think you're going to track a story down to a country only to find out that actually it only stayed a month or so and then it's moved on again. And what you normally find is the paperwork in the country you're going to no longer exists. So there doesn't seem to be a paper trail to chase it along. So it's a little bit of guesswork, a little bit of the existing paperwork we have back in the UK and a little bit of luck, I think.
I take it you worked out that Philip Morris is the same bloke who wrote that forum posting we just heard, yes?
I got a call from a friend of mine the day after Underwater Menace 2 and Galaxy 4 had been screened at BFI.
This is Charles Daniels talking to TV Cream via Skype back in September before things got big.
And he said, oh, by the way, I was told by someone who should know that all of Hartnell's been recovered and none of Troughton.
No, of course not. There's nothing...
Charles is in it up to his neck. On the forums at Gallifrey Base, he's been one of the main go-to guys for speculation on the hunt for missing episodes. When he first heard what has come to be known as the Omni Rumour,
I just thought, that's so ridiculous, I'm going to put it out of my mind.
But things started to happen, including companion Annika Wills supposedly saying things she shouldn't at a convention.
She had apparently said to some people at a convention bar that there was even more surprises to come for Doctor Who fans, and then one of her handlers shushed her immediately, saying, you really shouldn't be saying this. And apparently she mouthed the Power of the Daleks to some friends.
Doctor Who fans on the scent of Philip Morris started to play amateur detective, uncovering paperwork of a shipment in late 2011 of 3 tons of film material arriving to Liverpool from Lagos, and telephoning television stations in Africa. One person went a little further in an attempt to flush out whether or not secret restoration of missing episodes was ongoing at the BBC.
What he did was he pretended he was a haulage, a lorry driver, and he had a ripped package that he needed to deliver. And, oh, the only thing I can make out on this address is it says Doctor Who Restoration Team, BBC. But I don't know where to deliver this. So he called all these BBC departments and film restoration people asking, well, where would I send this package? Apparently, he eventually got someone who said, oh, well, that's not us. You've got to go call Perivale. They're the ones doing that work.
So what's so terrible about Perivale?
Nothing ever happens here.
Dateline, 10th of October 2013. So, we're back where we started. We're in that historic screening. There's Lizzo already drafting his tweets, and there's a raft of Whovians preparing to completely disregard the midnight embargo. Because when it comes to Doctor Who and missing episodes, possessing them, or even just possessing privileged information about them, is currency. But where's the man of the moment, Philip Morris? Surely he'd want to be here at his moment of glory. That is, unless he knows there are bigger moments still to come. Or maybe he's locked in negotiations on 2 telephones with Roger K. Barrett and Darren Gregory.
I wish I could get hold of him.
We've had a bit of fun at his expense here, but he did help put the kibosh on the big billing old Who, and has over the years turned up a number of missing apps. As Ian himself might say, enough said. I know that's Marvel Comics, isn't it? Truth be told, at the time of this recording, we've got a sneaking feeling that the full story of Philip Morris's missing episode escapade is yet to come out. Perhaps we'll just have to wait for the 30-year rule. After all, we've waited ages for this. Because this, folks, is the actual sound of the very moment when, for the first time in 45 years, Enemy of the World Part 1 was screened to the public.
Things that people thought were gone forever, no, they're not. They're back, and you can enjoy them now. So, get watching.
Line, happy times and places.
And at number one in TV Cream's countdown of the 50 greatest Doctor Who moments, we have Dewey.
Well, just in case there's anybody out there who really doesn't know what it looks like or sounds like, this is actually what you see on the programme.
Hello, podcast listeners. Be it squawking brass and shrieking electrical hoofa doofa, a stack of icy synths, the twang of a tremolo, urban rap.
Who such as me to find the light that glows so darkly in the night? Toward that point, I guide my feet.
The Doctor Who theme has been assailed by an army of passing fads, trends, and gimmicks bigger than any mustard this side of Winifred Atwell. And it has survived them all. Here are 4 reasons it's not just the greatest thing about Doctor Who, but one of the greatest signature tunes ever. first, it's in a minor key. And signature tunes in a minor key are pretty much always great. Why? Because they're so unusual, and therefore can't help but sound fresh and intriguing, as well as brooding, melancholy, wistful, and all the other things you never get when being hourly hosed with a load of major thirds. Now, don't get me wrong, there are plenty of stunning signature tunes in a major key. But there are also plenty of rotten ones as well. I can't think of a single signature tune in a minor key, however, that isn't at the very least curious, and at most, stunning. Listen. This is Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Here's the Sweeney. And here's How We Used to Live. Tunes in a minor key were rare enough in the 60s, but they're almost unheard of today. We're lucky Doctor Who is still around to keep us regularly topped up with heptatonic. Second, that rhythm. The rum-ti-tum knock on the door.
Yatta-ta-ta.
That has pounded away resolutely for 50 years underneath all the different monodic and harmonic fancies composers and arrangers have farted about with for good or ill. It's been around in music for at least 200 years. Here it is in the third movement of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, premiered in 1808. In Mendelssohn's Wedding March, composed in 1842. And the opening of Mahler's Fifth Symphony, premiered in 1904. There's nothing new, basically, about having a rat-a-ta-ta,
yat-a-ta-ta,
as the foundation for a musical romp. But that's no bad thing. If you want to get people to feel kinship with your work, you can do worse than turn to something that's been deployed, borrowed, nicked, reworked, inverted and lampooned for centuries. Moreover, something that can lend its oomph to everything from Morecambe and Wise to Pink Floyd.
The tune I always think of when anyone mentions Doctor Who is the high-pitched one, the...
He's talking about... the do come in to the... and the harmonically ribald, melodically unconventional, vocally taxing but indisputably Doctor Who bit of the Doctor Who signature tune. The actual... pivots around a musical interval that is properly described as an augmented octave or a minor ninth, and also a bloody horrible sound. It's hugely rare in music, and unless it's followed by swift resolution, as in the case of the Doctor Who theme, it's pretty unpalatable, but it's sufficiently otherworldly to serve as a just about catchy motif for someone who is from another world. It's only when the gets messed about with that it stops working, which leads us directly to reason number four. Oh God. Oh, you don't mess with a hit. Unless you're trying to make the hit turn a flop back into a hit. But that never works either. That the Doctor Who theme went shit in the late 80s is a matter of record, or records, if you were of a mind to try and buy each sequential tin-eared version. If it's possible to grit or brace your teeth as it does your ears, do so now, as we remind ourselves of the cheap and dreary Doctor Who theme of 1986. Of a GCSE music classroom full of mini Casio keyboards and wankers in 1987, and of a pile of crap from 1993. But all of these latter-day, bastardised, wretched versions ultimately served a greater purpose by elevating yet further the status of the original, whose prestige has only grown over time. And when the show came back in 2005, the Do-wee-oo. Was back where it belonged. Given all this, the fact it's been buggered up again since is no surprise. But it means we're due for another renaissance somewhere around 2033, when the show gets revived for a 70th anniversary special, with a cast including Ben Whishaw, Miranda Hart, Eddie Mair, and the voice of Len Goodman. I give this theme Ben!
I'm looking for the Doctor.
They call me the Doctor.
I am 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 the Doctor.
I'm the Doctor. But probably not the one you expected.
I am a Doctor.
I am the Doctor.
I am the Doctor.
I am the Doctor.
Across the universe.
Pool of sorrow.
The waves of joy.
I drifting.
Through a man of comfort.
My
possessing.
And.
Capacity.
Me!
Make their way across the universe.
Well, our work here is just about done. TV Cream would like to thank the following for their contributions to this five-part podcast series: Karen Bartke, Jonathan Carley, Simon Cartwright, Charles Daniels, Peter Dixon, Debbie Flint, Ryan Hendrick, Keith Miller, Dom O'Shea, John Peake, Rose Ruane, Matthew Rudd, Ian Sears, Chip Suddeth, Hamish Wilson, and anyone who posted some kind of clip on YouTube or Video Motion or somewhere else which we've mercilessly pilfered. Nothing's gonna change my world. If you're still in the mood for reminiscences about Doctor Who, we recommend you hunt down the book Behind the Sofa, Celebrity Memories of Doctor Who. It's edited by Steve Berry, but it's still good, and it's raising money for Alzheimer's Research UK. Find out more at www.doctorwhobook.com.
Well, we must be off. Goodbye, sir.
Goodbye, Doctor.
Bye, Doctor.
Don't forget me.
Goodbye, Doctor.
Don't go too far away, will you? And if you do, come back and see you sometimes.
Goodbye, Doctor.
Goodbye, Doctor.
Goodbye, Doctor.
Goodbye, Doctor.
Oh, it's not goodbye.
You say it, please. This time.
Where he is right now?
Hey, Doctor, wherever you are.
Shh. Someone coming.
Goodbye, Doctor. Thanks for the ride.
It was fun, Doctor. Goodbye.
Goodbye, Scrandall. Goodbye, Doctor.
Goodbye, Doctor.
Oh, goodbye, Ingrid. Goodbye.
And there, my dear Doctor, and my dear TV Cream podcast listeners, we reach the end. The final end. Because, unbeknownst to you, all this time, I have been unleashing my most fiendish trap ever. Oh yes, even now, a Dalek battle fleet is entering Earth's orbit, locking on to a covert signal I see throughout this transmission. This will be my greatest triumph! Hello?
Dalek Supreme speaking!
Ah, Dalek Supreme. To what do I owe this very great pleasure?
The Daleks are double booked. We are no longer available to invade the Earth.
I'm sorry, what?
The Daleks have an audition for a Kit Kat commercial.
You have an audition for a Kit Kat commercial? Why of all the...
Daleks must pursue all fee-paying opportunities.
Yes, I understand. You have to go where the work is.
Daleks will reconvene with the Master at some other designated time.
Very well. Goodbye. Oh, curses. Another time, perhaps.